state of Alaska without an agenda or final vote in the
Mr. Reed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Stephen Reed. I will be presenting argument on behalf of the joint petitioners in this case, except with respect to the issue of pooling and uniform rate, on which I am presenting only on behalf of the indicated TAPS carriers, as identified in the brief. And I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. I'm, of course, happy to address any of the issues that are raised in the briefs, but I'd like to focus on three to the extent I can. I
take it mandamus is not one of those.
Mandamus is not one of those, Your Honor. First of all, the use of the TAPS settlement methodology balances to set the rates for the TAPS carriers in this case. Secondly, the Commission's retroactive change of methodologies requiring refunds back to 2005. And third, the Commission's imposition of a mandatory pooling mechanism on the TAPS carriers. And again, that third issue will be on behalf only of the indicated TAPS carriers. Let's start with the first two issues, which I think are interrelated. That is the Commission's decision on the one hand to say that TSM, the TAPS settlement methodology, was the actual methodology used to set these rates for the period from 1977 to 2004, and therefore it was appropriate to take the balances from that settlement and carry them forward into the methodology used to set the 2005 rates. We think there is an inherent tension between that holding, on the one hand, which we think is incorrect, and the Commission's decision in 2008 that having changed that governing methodology, they could make their decision retroactive back to 2005, even though the TAPS carriers did not propose any change in that methodology. Both of those propositions may be wrong, which we believe, but they both can't be right. We submit that the TAPS settlement methodology was, as this court recognized in ASRC versus FERC, when the settlement was first up here, was simply a settlement between the TAPS carriers and the state of Alaska. What it in essence said was, there's this formula that we've agreed on, and as long as the TAPS carriers abide by that formula, the state of Alaska can't come in and challenge the TAPS rates as too high. That was really all it determined. It did not set rates, it did not establish rates for any other parties. The Commission, however, has essentially now retroactively attempted to change the nature of that agreement and say, no, the TAPS settlement methodology was the actual methodology setting the rates. And therefore, it's appropriate, because of that, to take those balances forward and impose them on the carriers, basically to start with the parts of the settlement that the shippers liked and work down from there to the rates that were actually set.
Am I right in thinking that you accept the proposition that that the carriers received these sums of money that they received, right? I mean, that is accepted.
They earned the revenues they earned, Your Honor.
They earned the revenues they earned.
The question is whether
the question is the characterization of those revenues.
Precisely so. And what the Commission has done here is to take at face value the elements that were in the settlement and say just because those were what the settlement said, necessarily that must really have been collected. But the whole point was...
Can I just, on the characterization bit, so this means then, I think, that if, for example, there was accelerated depreciation under the TSM and they allocate money to reduction of the rate base because of that, you say, no, the rate base only declined on a basis of straight line depreciation, and all the rest was return on equity, I guess. Is that right?
Well, Your Honor, the way I would put it is the settlement was a package. There was a trade-off between various elements within the settlement. Yes, within the settlement, depreciation was clearly accelerated, but at the same time, the carriers agreed to a very low rate of return in the settlement, 6.4%.
Right.
Well below what
I don't know that was the trade-off, though, because the at least the ALJ and FERC said no. The reason you wanted accelerated depreciation is because that enabled you to save $1.5 billion of windfall profits tax that you would otherwise pay, And if I were the lawyer engaging in the settlement negotiations, I would know that Ronald Reagan had run on a platform of repealing that tax. So I'd want the depreciation accelerated in the early years, pending, and then in the later years I wouldn't care because the tax would be repealed, and in fact it was.
Well, Your Honor, we really don't know what the motivation of the settling parties was.
Well, you just told us, though, that what we would have done is sought a higher rate rather than if we had gone straight line, but I don't know that's the case.
Well, I think you're addressing primarily the period from 77 to 85. Recognize the settlement was made in 85, and part of the settlement was determining, you know, what the rates would be for the back years. But the part that's really of significance here is what happened since 1985. The rate base under the TSM and the rate base under 154B were essentially identical in 1985. The issue is what's happened since then. And the Commission's view is, well, you agreed to this accelerated depreciation, so you effectively got all your money up front. You shouldn't get it again. The carrier's point is, we only agreed with the state on a going-forward ceiling on the rates.
You didn't use accelerated depreciation in your tax accounting, though, did you?
Well, I believe they would have used accelerated depreciation for tax purposes, but that's accounted for through the deferred tax account, Your Honor. I mean, it's normalized over the whole life. I don't believe there's been an issue as to the taxes. But, you know, on the double recovery point, the Commission never went back and looked to see if the carriers earned excessive revenues during those years. And, in fact, the only evidence that was presented on 154B basis, the carriers did a calculation. What would their 154B rates under the Commission's standard conventional methodology have been from 1985 to 2004, and they had a chart that showed in virtually every year the 154B rates would have been higher because the carriers would have been getting a higher rate of return and other elements that were in 154B that weren't in the TSM.
That hypothetical has never been adjudicated, isn't that right?
That's correct. The Commission made no finding on that, and the whole point is...
Your argument in the end seems to be that what the Commission ought to have done is to completely replay 1985 through 2004 and ask where things would have been if we had adjudicated all the disputes and see what would have been left. And then what happens with respect to the money that's flowed in those 20 years?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I think that is exactly what we're saying, and it's exactly what the Commission does in every 154B case. When a pipeline comes in for the first time, as happened in the Lakehead case, you know, years after 154B was put in place, Lakehead came in for the very first time to file a rate under 154B. The Commission didn't say, oh, we're going to, you know, pick you up right here with whatever was in your rate from the 1980s. They said, we're going to go back to 1983 and calculate what your rate base would have been using the 154B methodology, straight line depreciation. They gave them a starting rate base. All the TAPS carriers have ever asked for is to be treated just like any other oil pipeline would have been without regard to those balances that were in the settlement. Because in our view, and we think this court said it in 1985, those were not intended to be precedential for litigated rates set on behalf of parties later on who weren't parties to the settlement.
I guess at least a standard notion of precedential would be that the actual rules adopted in the TSM would forever continue, and you weren't claiming that that's happened.
No, Your Honor, but I think what the court meant in ASRC in context, because you had a party there who was challenging the settlement rates, and the court said to that party, you can come back later. You're not aggrieved today because this rate hasn't applied to you yet, but when it is, you can come back. But the point is, when you come back, you have to litigate your rate in its entirety. You can't rely on the things that were in the settlement and then take those as a starting point and litigate everything else. And we think that treating the settlement as evidence of what actually happened during this period without going back and trying to look at whether there was excessive cost recovery is doing exactly what this court said you shouldn't do. Looking at it on the flip side, if we take the Commission's view, which is that TSM was the governing methodology through all these years and it is an appropriate place to look, it's what actually happened, then we bump up against the prospectivity rule because the Commission decided in 2008 that they were going to change the TSM methodology that had been used, in their view, to set the rates all these years. And that, presumably, if they could overcome our first argument, that they had the right to do. But what they didn't have the right to do was to change that methodology retroactively, because they were clearly exercising their rate prescription authority under 15.1 when they made that decision. And I think under a long line of this court's cases, like C. Robin, like East Tennessee Gas, when the commission is changing the formula that's used to set the rates, that is a rate prescription that is supposed to be prospective.
C. Robin has a sentence that you don't quote, which is, nor was the commission's methodology a return to C. Robin's pre-filing rates. Now, isn't, if I understand this correctly, that's exactly what the commission's remedy here was, a return to the carrier's pre-filing rates, limiting you, cutting you off at the 2004 levels.
I think that is correct, Your Honor, but merely because we were in a case initiated by a rate filing. I think this court's decision in Oxy, for example, says specifically, just because you're in a case where you started with a rate filing and the rates were suspended and made subject to refund, doesn't necessarily mean that the commission, when it changes something fundamental about the methodology, can make that retroactive and require refunds simply because of the change. If I think what happened in East Tennessee Gas is
retroactive. They have to, once there's a protest to your 2005 filing, they have to adjudicate it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if they provide the normal remedy, which is to limit you to the previously filed rates, what makes that retroactive?
Well, Your Honor, for 20 years we had filed these rates under the commission's theory under TSM. They had accepted them under TSM. That was the accepted practice. We filed once again under TSM, and the only thing that changed was that the inputs that were permitted by TSM, increases in operating costs, changes in throughput, were calculated for 2005, and no one argues that that was done incorrectly. The commission 3 years later says, oh, by the way, TSM is not an appropriate methodology. We're now changing our rules. And I think in East Tennessee Gas, this court made clear that when you didn't violate the commission policy as it existed on the day you filed your rate, that's not subject to refund until the commission changes its mind and says, no, that's no longer the acceptable policy. I'd like, before I run out of time, just to turn briefly to the issue of pooling, which is a considerable concern to the indicated TAPS carriers. First of all, we think this is clearly a ripe issue. It is a purely legal issue.
How did this issue get into this case? Because the problem presented was filings of 2005, 2006 rates, and we're looking at it under 15.7, right? And yet we subtly find the ALJ and the commission ordering something that seems to be entirely with respect to future years.
Well, Your Honor, and not even the ALJ, I think it was the commission for the first time imposed the pooling in a rehearing order in this case. There was no hearing held on pooling, which was one of our issues. And the commission's rationale was that this was all related to their having to prescribe a uniform rate for the TAPS carriers. The dual problems we see,
I guess there are really two things going on that I'm concerned about. One is that this looks to me sort of like the start of a new rate proceeding with respect to future rates, not 05, not 06. I'm a little puzzled how that came into the case. And then the other thing, which is connected to that, is the fact that this seems to relate to an ultimate rate disposition that has never been made by the commission. So, I mean, it just seems like a preliminary order with respect to a future rate case.
Well, Your Honor, I think the dilemma for us is we have an order from the commission that said unequivocally the TAPS carriers must agree to and file with us a pooling. Admittedly, there are further proceedings going on right now about what the form of that pooling will be, but whether the commission, you know, whether the case started that way or not, the commission has issued an order.
They've said you must have
a pooling.
That makes it sound very much like an ordinary interlocutory order in a rate case that has not come to fruition.
Well, but for the fact that the commission has shown no indication, and I think that they cite the Eagle Pitcher case, I think it's a good precedent for us, because there the court said, once the commission has said, this is the, we've reached a final determination on the legal issue. They've said, we will impose a pooling, whether the carriers agree to it or not.
There is a discrete legal issue that you could find there, but I don't suggest it was, you had to hunt for it. It was sitting there. But the application and meaning of that legal issue seems to me something the commission hasn't come to a disposition on.
Can you tell me what you mean by pooling?
This pooling is not defined in the statute, Your Honor, but it has been defined through a series of decisions by the agencies over the years, and it basically is the sharing of traffic or revenue or any portion of the revenue among competing carriers. And here we have five competing carriers, and the commission has directed them to reallocate a portion of their revenue, namely certain costs. We don't know exactly which ones yet because that is to be determined, but has required them to do that, despite the fact that a number of the carriers didn't agree to that decision. And under the statute, I mean, turning to the merits, whether this is ripe, I suppose, is up to the court to decide. We certainly had no discretion about appealing now, I think, given the clarity of the commission's order. But whether it's ripe, I think this court will have to determine. But assuming it's ripe, it seems to us clear.
I think that's an important point. I mean, if you had not filed or in your petition, if you had not raised this issue, you were concerned that it would have been considered final.
Yes, Your Honor, yeah, absolutely. I think this could have been construed as a final decision, and that would have put us in an impossible bind. Turning to the merits, the statute seems very clear on its face that the assent of all carriers is required to a pooling, and the Supreme Court has affirmed that in the Escanaba case. The commission doesn't really take issue with the idea that that's required when 5-1 applies. They just say, well, we're not required to follow 5-1 here because we weren't doing what 5-1 is all about. But the problem with that is the statute explicitly says whether it's the carriers coming with an agreement of their own or the commission acting on its own initiative, they still have to come under 5-1.
The commission's argument fundamentally is that 5-1 does not occupy the field, right?
And we think on its face it does, Your Honor, and there's no precedent in the 120 or 30 years that we've had the Interstate Commerce Act for in either agency, the ICC or the FERC, operating outside of 5-1 to impose
this
pooling.
In order to file uniform rates and under a pooling arrangement, is the commission telling independent corporations that they must, on pain of some sort of fine or something, agree with each other on something they don't agree with each other on?
Well, certainly with respect to the pooling, I think that's clear, Your Honor. That is exactly what they're telling the carriers, is that you must supersede the agreements you have in place and make new agreements that we're going to impose on how you share the costs of this facility.
Suppose the carriers come back and say, we struggled and struggled, and we do not agree, and here are the following positions. You do what? I mean, they aren't going to fine you for that, are they?
Well, it's unclear. There is a proceeding going on right now before the commission to determine the form of the pooling, and there are multiple competing presentations on what it should look like, although all of that is in the context of the commission having mandated that there has to be some pooling. That is, none of the options are not to have one.
Right.
It's simply what form it's going to take.
That's going to produce a clearly appealable order, right?
Presumably there will be an appealable order at the end of that process.
It seems improbable to me, but I don't know. I don't know how the commission works, that they're going to punish you for not agreeing with each other.
Well, so far they have not.
What?
So far they have not. One assumes at the end of that proceeding they're going to prescribe a form of pooling.
Yeah.
Pick one of those or come up with one of their own, and that's going to be when it's imposed on the carriers. Agreed. If I may, I'll reserve whatever time I have left.
Well, you don't have any, but we'll try and give you some.
Good morning. I'm Bradley Louie, appearing on behalf of the State of Alaska, Petitioner State of Alaska. I've asked for to reserve 2 minutes of time for rebuttal. The state's appeal in this case presents the question of whether the TAPS owner should be allowed to retain $500 million of discriminatory collections that they collected in their 2005 and 2006 rates. There's no question in this case that the collections were discriminatory. After the refunds that were ordered in this case to the 2004 rate level, there was still over a 50% difference in the interstate and intrastate rates. And the TAPS carriers themselves agreed that there was no justification for differences in rates on TAPS.
But you've not purported to show competitive damages.
The state of Alaska has not shown competitive damages, and in this case, because of the state's position, that's not, we don't think that that's the proper relief. That would be reparations, essentially. And as the Supreme Court's...
Where do you get that?
Reparations under reparations damages remedy would be the reparations. And as the Supreme Court in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline rate cases talked about, the reparations remedy for those damages. It said that because of the situation of TAPS and the state of Alaska as the royalty and taxing interest that it has, that reparations, which is really the damages remedy, is a particularly ineffective remedy. And it said that clearly in their decision. And so that from the standpoint of the state believes that it is entitled to get refunds in this case, refunds which would be the effective remedy that would require the TAPS carriers to disgorge the discriminatory collections that they had. That would be under the commission's ancillary authority.
Sorry. It seems to be an argument that because you're not in a position to get the kind of remedy that the statute actually provides, you ought to get a completely different remedy, more loosely calculated, more favorably to you, that the statute doesn't provide for.
It is not.
Have I summarized your position?
That is correct. It's not specifically enumerated in the statute, but as the Supreme Court held 15-7, which is the issue that we have on refunds only for the amount of the increase, they said 15-7 is not exclusive, and that's why they said in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline rate cases that this commission can go outside the 15-7. And it would be appropriate in this case because of the situation that we have here where the state of Alaska is the royalty holder, it's not a shipper. And also it is appropriate under the settlement agreement between the TAPS carriers and state, the TAPS settlement agreement, under section 211E of that agreement, it provides that the carrier shall charge rates that are non-discriminatory. And the state is also acting under that settlement agreement and is asking for appropriate relief. Now, the commission itself has said that it is bound by the TAPS settlement agreement, and that was in their Amara and Hess Pipeline Corp case at 79 FERC 61300 at 62357 note 19, where they say they are bound. So they are bound to enforce the provisions of the settlement agreement which require non-discriminatory rates.
How did they become discriminatory?
They became discriminatory because the intrastate rate is much lower than the interstate rate.
And the reason the intrastate rate is lower is because?
Because the RCA ordered the TAPS carriers to lower their rates to it.
The RCA is?
The Regulatory Commission of Alaska, which is the authority.
So the state of Alaska lowers the intrastate rate and then charges a refund, gets reparations for having caused the discrimination?
No, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska is the independent agency that regulates rates. The state of Alaska that I'm representing.
It's an entity of the state of Alaska, isn't it?
It is an independent agency of the state of Alaska.
Right.
And so the Shreveport.
Why isn't the right answer to raise their rates then if they're causing intrastate discrimination? Why not just have the one of the Supreme Court opinions suggests that FERC can actually just raise the intrastate rate when it has a discriminatory effect on interstate commerce.
And that wouldn't be inappropriate in this case.
That wouldn't?
It would not be appropriate in this case because first of all, the FERC found under the federal methodology that the properly applied, there was essentially no difference under the federal methodology of a just and reasonable rate as a state methodology. And the raising the rate to above what the federal level was ultimately found to be was not a power that the FERC had, because under Section 13.4 of the Interstate Commerce Act, they can only raise it to the amount that would have the rates meet the fair share of the intrastate traffic. So under the Shreveport case, the only solution here, and it's and also New York versus the United States, that those cases dictate that the federal level be lowered to remove the discrimination, and that's why there is discrimination. Under the FERC itself found that that under the federal methodology there was no justification for the differences in the rates. So there and that was the application of their own methodology. So there really is no issue here about intruding on the rate-making powers of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It's under their own methodology. They found the equivalent, essentially the equivalent rate. So so I think that's clear that the FERC should have given the state effective relief in this case, effective relief being refunds, since it was bound. It itself said it was bound by the settlement agreement, and it was therefore bound to enforce the agreement and bound to give the state an effective remedy in this case. Now, on brief, the commission now says that it exercises discretion not to order refunds here down below the 2004 rate. That's nowhere in the order. It's not supported in the order. And under Chenery, that can't be the basis for sustaining the order. They said that they did not have the power to lower the rate below the 2004 level. And so under Chenery, they can't now say that they just acted in their own discretion. With respect to, there was some issues that have been raised about Section 211E. 211E is a provision that requires the tax carriers, yes, to comply with the law. But that's just like in any common government consent decree where the government requires the parties to comply with the law and has the option to seek enforcement of the law under the consent decree. And that's what this is. And if you look at the introductory statement, the introductory statement to the settlement agreement says that the agreement is designed to result in just and reasonable rates and non-discriminatory rates. The provision that requires non-discriminatory rates is Section 211E. So I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Judith Albert for FERC. I'll be addressing the costing issues in this case raised by the carriers. To begin with, on the pooling issue, I think the discussion earlier does underscore the correctness of FERC's position that the pooling issue is not ripe at this time because it will be addressed in detail in the ongoing proceeding and because
Can you answer my question about what it means for the Commission to order these pipelines to submit uniform rates and pooling arrangements? I mean, literally, it sounds like ordering people to agree with each other who profoundly disagree with each other.
Well, actually, as the case that's ongoing is unfolding, the carriers have not submitted rates together, and they have not
theoretically. If you read some of the commission's language, they're under some sort of Damocles to do so.
I think what the commission is saying is that the rationale underlying the need for uniform rates is that there is one pipeline here, one pipeline, five owners.
You're getting into the merits. I'm just worried about this procedure, which does seem to be related to your non-ripeness argument and has to do with whether, I guess it seems to me fantastic that the commission would, in fact, punish independent entities for failing to agree with each other.
I would assume that in the ongoing...
happen.
In the ongoing case, that there have been different different, the carriers have submitted their rates separately. I understand that they have submitted separate rates. They've submitted different ideas on pooling. I would assume that this case would be like any other case, that the commission will examine the merits of the different proposals and determine.
So it's not, it's effectively not an order for them to agree.
No.
I'd like to have them agree, but.
In fact, I understand from the stipulation of issues in the ongoing case that the degree to which there has to be uniformity and how the carriers exactly will be filing their rates, whether they have to file them at the same time or separately or use the same costing right. moment in time, will be deciding in the ongoing case.
Okay. Thank you.
I will address the...
You're not done, are you?
I'm not used to not having a question come up. On the refund issue, the commission's position is that the
refunds of what?
The carrier's position is that the refund issue has to do with whether the commission can order refunds of the due to the rates that they prescribed for 2005 and 2006.
Are you talking about dismantling now?
No, I'm talking about ordering refunds, but we can talk about dismantling if you would prefer.
All right. Go ahead.
You're talking about the initial major argument by the carrier.
Right. The initial right. major argument that the TSM methodology right. is right. the methodology that was the commission accepting and approved and so forth and yeah. binds these parties, and that any change now to a 154B straight line methodology standard costing methodology represents a change of methodology, and that is not correct. The TAPS methodology was in a settlement. The commission never approved that methodology or any of the rates as just and reasonable. The commission simply accepted the settlement as under the uncontested settlement standard, which is that the settlement appeared to be in the public interest. And at the time the commission accepted the settlement, it emphasized that the settlement did not bind shippers. Shippers would be able to bring protests and other actions under Section 15 of the Interstate Commerce Act like they would in any other kind of case. And that commission finding was affirmed by this court in Arctic Slope. Accordingly.
In oral argument, Mr. Reed mentioned the Lakehead case, which I must say I had not focused on. But as characterized by him, he says that it's parallel to this and that the solution adopted by the commission there was indeed to go back over the whole period that had been lived through under one regime and re-examine it under a completely different regime in order to figure out where the commission and the parties were at the relevant moment.
The Lakehead case is not like this case at all. In Lakehead, the carrier had priced its products, its transportation on the old valuation method. The valuation method, which was replaced by the commission after several remands from this court and other methodologies, the commission replaced the valuation method with the opinion 154B method, which is your standard traditional cost-based rate-making methodology with a different kind of rate-based construction. In Lakehead, the carrier had based its rates on the valuation method with a valuation rate base. It had not received or utilized deferred return during the entire time, and this was, I can't remember the exact date, up maybe in the 1990s or sometime past the point when the commission had said that we had to make the switch between valuation rate base and the TOC rate base. Commission said that since this carrier had used the valuation rate base, it had never used the deferred return that's allowed under the TOC method, it could now do so and it could begin calculating its deferred return as of 1983. In the case here, The carriers have never used the valuation rate base as a final rate for collecting any rates.
Yeah, Mr. Reed was seen to be invoking it for a broader principle than he had invoked it in his brief, and that is for this general proposition that it's appropriate to go back and regurgitate the entire life experience under the settlement, although understanding that not everybody agreed to the settlement. I take it you're telling me that's a dramatic over-reading of Lakehead.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's a dramatic over-reading of the case. All the commission did in Lakehead was to allow Lakehead to collect deferred return, which it had never done because it had continued for many years using valuation rate making.
What do you say to Mr. Reed's other point that basically there's cherry picking going on here, that this wasn't, you can't use the settlement as evidence of anything, it was one overall thing, and the balances aren't particularly relevant?
There's no cherry picking here at all. The settlement had very complex, had many elements. Among the benefits that the carriers received from the settlement was the fact that they did not have to pay huge amounts of refunds early on because they were allowed to do this accelerated depreciation and accelerated collection of other items, and they were allowed to take this $450 million rate base and amortize it over a very short period of time. This wiped out a huge amount of refunds. The second benefit that the carriers got, and have gotten it for over 20 years, was that the state of Alaska did not protest any of their rates. This is the benefits that the carriers got out of the settlement package. The package is over now. All the commission did, it didn't look at the settlement methodology when it computed the rates here. The commission looked at the record for the best evidence of record as to what costs the carriers had already recovered. And the commission concluded that over a period of these 20 years with over 100 rate filings and the accompanying documents that indicated how these rates were computed and satisfied the transportation, TAPS methodology, the commission decided that the numbers in those documents were the best evidence of record as to what the carriers have already collected. And that's a very reasonable judgment, I submit. Do you have any other areas that you would like me to address?
Are you dealing with the issue of DR&R?
Well, the commission's position on that, too, is that it's not right because whether there will ever be an issue of refunds of those monies will not arise for many, many years.
Certainly, isn't there a pretty immediate impact on the carriers from the commission's, I take it, unequivocal ruling that if the numbers work out that way, there must be refunds?
But
I mean, that would seem to me to
that's
have
that's
an
the
immediate
commission.
Impact on how you treat money you've received, and
well, the fact of the matter,
what
the,
sort of accounting adjustments.
The fact is that even if the commission hadn't made that ruling, it's not like the carriers had no obligation to
pay
for dismantling.
I understand that, but they're suppose the carriers thought, well, in fact, it's going to work out pretty well, and we'll be able to do this for much less than the amount that will have been accumulated at the relevant moment. And its investors make that appraisal too. The commission's ruling says that appraisal is not right.
I don't remember anything in the record, or at least anything that the commission cited regarding the expectations of investors on this.
If one's talking about ripeness,
but
it seemed to me that would be pertinent.
But in this case, the whole thing is so theoretical because the pipeline's useful life will be going to at least 2034 and possibly longer because the useful life of the pipeline is being litigated, as I understand it, in the ongoing case. So the court may never have to decide this issue if it waits.
It's only being litigated for depreciation purposes. I mean, the actual life of the pipeline might be something else entirely, right?
Correct. That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And as far as investors are concerned, these pipelines, like other corporations, keep separate sets of books. I mean, you have a separate set of books for tax purposes. You have a separate set of books.
I understand that carriers have four sets of books.
To the SEC, you have a separate set of books for rate making. You have another set of books for FERC. I mean, I don't know which one the investor looks at, but the accounting part of this thing is only for FERC reporting, right?
The accounting requirement.
But the obligation is for the real world.
Well, we don't know whether there'll be an obligation. That depends on whether in fact the dismantling costs are less than the amount collected, and that's.
And that depends on exactly what the state and the federal governments, and possibly any landowners that might be involved, might argue should be done in these activities. And of course, it depends on how much these activities cost. And of course, that's at least 25 years in the future.
Well, on the assumption or on the hypothetical that it's ripe, you want to defend it on the merits?
Yes. Dismantling costs are a little bit unique because there is no actual expenditure required of the carrier for many, many years. And the dismantling costs are built into the rates early on so that the costs can be spread over all generations of shippers. And as the parties indicated before the ALJ in their pleadings, they expected this fund to be neutral. In other words, the carriers don't expect to make money on this particular cost item. And that's, of course, also consistent with traditional cost of service rate making. Carriers are entitled under traditional cost of service rate making to their recovery of their costs, and also to a rate of return on their investment.
Why isn't this just subject to the filed rate doctrine, which one way of looking at the filed rate doctrine, at least, is sometimes they win and sometimes they lose. But the rate is the rate.
The commission's policy, in which we believe that the parties understood at the time of the proceeding because of their statements that this was to be a revenue neutral fund. The commission's policy is that the dismantling costs are for the purpose of paying for the dismantling, and the carriers are not entitled to make money on that fund. And so if there's any money left over after the dismantling and renovation activities occur, then the shippers are entitled to its return.
Did the commission say at the outset that this fund was to be revenue neutral?
No.
The commission's orders do not really address that point.
So when you say that this was the commission's policy and they knew it, what's the citation for that?
The ALJ cited two briefs of the commission staff and of the shippers, indicating, which then cited to portions of the record indicating that the carriers agreed that this fund was to be revenue neutral. And that's cited in our brief.
But that doesn't. How does that lead to the conclusion that if it's not there, if it's, you know, if the dismantling cost is less, that the refunds should be paid? I mean, the intention may have been in setting the amount to make it revenue neutral. But like I said, and the idea behind one of the principles of the filed rate doctrine, at least as the Supreme Court's expressed it in Maislin and other cases, is that. You know, sometimes the carriers are going to make out, but that's the rate. And sometimes they're going to lose, but that's the rate. So if it's revenue neutral, I don't see how that gets to the proposition that refunds are entitled to, or that they're subject to refunds.
Well, there's more to the amounts of money that are involved than the amounts that have been collected by the carriers through rates, because the carriers are also earning money on these amounts that the shippers have collected.
Yeah. That would be true.
It's always
of any rate revenue they received.
Yeah, but the carriers under a traditional cost of service rate making are not entitled to make money on cost funds that they have not spent.
No, that's not true. I mean, if it turns out that in a given past year that they had charges calculated on the basis of $10 million in costs, and their costs were $9,500,000, they get the $500,000, and they can do what they like with it.
Right.
That's true, but the dismantling costs are a very different kind of cost because they are collected many, many years before they are expended.
The commission's argument, I take it, is they're so peculiar that the carriers were on notice that they would be treated differently, so that the various cases that use notice as a satisfying the filed rate doctrine are applicable.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the settlement that says you have to give it back at the end or anything like that?
No.
And there wasn't a commission order in some other case at the time or anything like that?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Thank you
very
questions.
Much.
Thank you.
Good morning. Just to avoid any confusion, I'm addressing the state's argument regarding discrimination. Judge Williams, your question actually goes to the crux of this case. You asked the counsel for petitioner, is this a case where because you can't get the statutory remedy, you want some other remedy? And as the commission made clear numerous times in its order, the state never attempted to show reparations, which is the longstanding remedy, so longstanding that although we cited Campbell prominently in our brief, the Campbell case from 1933, which this court had cited in Council of Forest Industries, the commission quoted this court's succinct summary of that. It actually goes back at least as far as Pennsylvania Railroad, which we did mention in our brief, from 1913, I believe, that the court and the commission and its predecessor commission have long been clear that when we're talking about discrimination or undue preference, the remedy available under the statute, the theory is not refunds. The council talks about disgorgement or carriers being allowed to retain funds. And from Pennsylvania Railroad to Campbell and on, it's been quite clear that when we're talking about discrimination, it's not about overpayment or overcharge. It's about proving damages, which in some cases can be more than whatever the preference may have been. In some cases, they're less. But it's specific damages. In Pennsylvania Railroad, which Campbell relied on heavily, the court actually looked back at English courts to talk about the distinction between overcharge and damages. So there's nothing new. The commission did nothing new or radical here.
The damages you're talking about are only between competitors, right? I mean, how does Alaska show damages?
Since it's standing in the shoes of the competitors, I guess it would make the same kind of showing. It's hard for me to answer that because it's undisputed, as the commission said in its order, no party tried. The state nor anyone else tried. So we don't have the commission saying, oh, if you'd only shown this. Certainly the courts have given all sorts of examples, impacts on markets, impacts on prices. The Pennsylvania Railroad and I think Campbell both gave examples of what kinds of showing might be made. I can only speculate because there's no question that there was no such effort here. And efforts to some of the arguments today are about damages not being appropriate. That's new. As far as I know, I have not heard this citation of TAPS for that. That's new to me today. So I don't have an answer because I don't think we were ever given an opportunity to consider that. In fact, the petitioners in their opening brief never mentioned, despite the commission having said reparations or damages at least 10 times in the space of two or three paragraphs of its order, there was just no discussion of that in the opening brief. There's a slight reference in the reply brief at page 18 and 19 about how it wouldn't really get the state what we want because we're really interested in vindicating the settlement. But anything else as far as why 100 years of precedent is somehow not appropriate, that's fairly new.
I not have a very good understanding of this. Is this the argument regarding relief in the alternative?
Yes.
Okay, I thought the commission also said that they hadn't shown that it was unduly discriminatory.
It did. And before I get to that, let me just make one point. There are three parts of the statute that the commission discussed could be relevant. 15.1, which is the prospective setting of rates, which many of the cases are about, such as Shreveport and New York. And that's not at issue in this case because although the commission didn't make a finding of discrimination and set non-discriminatory rates, there's no dispute among any of the parties that the new reasonable rates that were set in response to other challenges are close enough that there's no longer a disparity. So there's no question going
close
forward.
Close enough to the intrastate rates? Close enough?
Close enough, yes. Yes, they're within a few cents of each other, I believe, going forward. So I don't think there's any dispute whatsoever as far as prospective relief or bringing one rate up or bringing the other rate down. That's not in this case. And that's certainly what most of the cases in the past have been, because reparations can be a difficult remedy to prove. So many of the cases are about prospective rate adjustments. So just to make clear, this is not a case where the Commission has seen discrimination and said, yeah, we'll leave it there. There's no issue going forward. And as to Section 13, reparations, damages, the Commission said, well, no party even tried, and that's the remedy, if you want to go back and collect money from before. So it's all about the refunds under Section 15.7. And the refunds were not, again, because the discrimination going forward was moot. The Commission didn't grant refunds on that. It granted refunds for unreasonable rates. But either way, the refunds under 15.7 are subject to the refund floor. Now, the petitioners have argued all along that they should get some alternative kind of remedy below the refund floor as an exercise either of the settlement or the ancillary authority. And the Commission said, well, there's a statutory remedy here that we've used for, I think the Commission didn't point out that it's 100 years old, but it is, and no one even tried, and that's the proper remedy. So the Commission didn't get into what might be necessary and incident in an exercise of ancillary authority, because there was no effort. It's not like anyone tried the existing remedy that's been there forever, and it wasn't enough. It wasn't even, the Commission said, that's the remedy. And but on the settlement, to point at the language, just if we look at JA 346, the language in the settlement says, notwithstanding any other provision, all tariff rates or surcharges shall be subject to the legal prohibitions upon unjust discrimination against and undue preference to shippers. So the Commission analyzed those legal prohibitions. Its whole analysis is about the statute. And just the settlement just reserved the application of the statute, so that's what the Commission focused on. Just a couple of quick points. I think I already touched on I think the council said there's no question these rates were discriminatory. Well, the Commission didn't make a finding on that because prospectively it was moot. What the Commission said is the remedy is really the end of this case. The Commission went on just to discuss, just to point out that it has never found a disparity in rates to be de facto discriminatory. And so it could have gotten to the same result, I mean, with the remedial.
The remedy and the wrong are integrated in the sense that unless there are discrimination damages, there isn't functionally discrimination.
Well, I don't think that's consistent with the way first of all, as I said, many of the discrimination cases come up prospectively. And that's where the issue of the disparity in rates and what rate needs to be fixed going forward. But when we're talking about retroactive relief,
that's
with reparations.
That's anticipating.
Right.
Well, competitive damages, right?
Well, it's also not allowing discriminatory rates to, to go forward. But when you look at the analyses of the Supreme Court, going back again to cases like Campbell and Pennsylvania Railroad, or even look at some of the ICC cases that were raised for the first time on appeal, like Iola Cement was one of them and Colonial Salt was the other. Those are cases where the Commission found discrimination in those cases and changed the rates prospectively, but denied reparations for lack of proof, because reparations are the standard. So even where there is discrimination, you don't come in and say, we have disparate rates, cut us a check.
Looking retrospectively, if the complainant fails to show competitive damages, there hasn't been, maybe it's a metaphysical question.
No, I can answer that.
There hasn't been any discrimination for substantive purposes. Would that be correct?
No. Actually, and again, I think some of the early ICC cases can actually help us with that. Again, I don't remember which one I'm thinking of specifically, but I know we cited both Iola Cement and Colonial Salt as being cases where they showed discrimination or preference. And the rates.
But is there a difference between the sort of discrimination alleged here between interstate and intrastate as opposed to discrimination among shippers?
Well, I believe those cases might, I'd have to look. I think those cases did involve interstate versus intrastate.
Yeah, I don't know.
So I'm not sure.
Is you're saying it's discriminatory if there's no cost or other basis for charging interstate and intrastate different, but that still may not be damaging to whoever's suing?
I think it's a little different. I don't want to conflate the discrimination from the damage. What the commission said is that with the discrimination, well, you see, it didn't have to make that exact finding in this case because it found the retroactive on the remedy basis and didn't have to make a finding going forward.
Well, no, I understand that.
Right. So that's where I get a little.
Judge Williams' question about whether these are the same questions or not, your answer was they're not the same
questions.
They're not.
That's right.
So can you give an example of what kind of damages could be proven?
Well, I don't know what they would
be. Not in this case.
Right.
In another case.
Certainly. And I would, there was a list in one of the cases. Several of the cases have said. It could be that it had an impact on a market. It made maybe the intrastate market more or less competitive. Mm-hmm. Or it gave.
Some shipper is deprived of an opportunity to make.
Right. I think some of the old ACs.
And recover his costs because he's in competition with
right.
someone who's got a better shipping deal.
One of the old ICC cases made that point where I think they even saw, this is why the courts say the reparations, the damages shown could actually be more because maybe some slight difference, not slight, but some difference in shipping costs shuts someone out of a market completely. And then one of the old ICC cases, they said it was a death sentence for the business. I don't know whether they were being a little flourish there, but it could. It's hard to say what form that proof would take, but there's at least a century in Pennsylvania Railroad. Looked back to the English courts. There's a lot of background in terms of what specific damages might be.
So what? In terms of the substantive rule against discrimination, And let's, if we can, confine ourselves to the backward-looking. The complainant, how can the complainant get anywhere without showing competitive losses in a market?
Backward?
Yeah.
They
show rate disparity, okay, fine.
Right.
But then...
I think the cases indicate, no, you have to show how you, or if the
right.
state of Alaska is representing a group, how whoever chooses their standing.
That's why I was arguing that the damage
I understand
characterization is intimately bound up with the substantive violation.
It can be, yes, yes. No, I'll agree with you on I think.
Yeah, as I say, maybe it's metaphysical.
I haven't seen the cases conflated that way, but when you phrase it that way, it may be when you're looking retrospectively. And that's why the ICC and now FERC have always said these are fact-bound cases. And it could be that the same facts go to both the injury and the remedy, that it would be tied together in that sense. I think that may be right. All right, thank you.
We'll hear from interveners, yes?
Good morning. My name is Robin Brenna, and I'm here on behalf of Anadarko and Tesoro. We're the folks that pay the rates. With my limited time, I'd like to focus the court's attention on just a few specific points. First, this is the first time that just and reasonable rates have been set on taps in 30 years of operation. It's a historic case.
Well, actually, can we go back on that?
This is the first time.
No, I understand what you said, but what I'm saying is, in fact, all that was concluded here is that the filings for 05 and 06 were not just and reasonable, and therefore the remedy was essentially that the 04 rate be charged.
Well, it's the first time that there's ever been a just and reasonable rate set. It's the first time that the commission...
They've been charging unjust and unreasonable rates for 30 years?
The commission has never addressed the issue of the justness and reasonableness of the rates prior to this case.
It's pointless, but it didn't seem to me that rates were set here. What we had was a finding that certain filed rates were unjust and unreasonable, and therefore the carriers were limited to collecting the prior unchallenged filed rate.
That's a fair characterization, okay. Judge Williams.
Sure.
And I want to point out to the court that what's before you isn't really substantive arguments in support of their excessive and unjust and unreasonable rates, but really procedural arguments. Procedural arguments which, if adopted by this court, will permit them to double recover their investment, avoid paying refunds, and not have a refund obligation as a result of recharacterizing their DRNR. Now, you heard the lead argument by the carriers was had to do with double recovery. The shippers in this case should not have to pay more than once for the carrier's investment in TAPS. They characterized this, the settlement that was entered into was a maximum rate settlement, and there was nothing in that settlement that required them to file rates at any level or under any methodology so long as it was under the maximum rate. That's important because we're not cherry-picking a settlement, and the balances in the settlement don't have anything to do with what FERC did. What we did and what FERC did was go back and take a look at the actual balances that were included in the rates that were charged. It's what we paid. And let's do this by period.
The commission characterized those sums of money in accordance with the TSM, right?
Well, the carriers characterized the sums of money. Let me do this by period, if I may, because it's slightly different by period. Prior to 1985, the commission, they not only got the benefit of the windfall's tax reduction, but they also reduced their refund obligations. We paid accelerated and front-end loaded rate elements prior to 1985, and as a result of it, we got lower refunds than we otherwise would have been entitled to. So that was real. We paid that. From 1985 forward, they filed each year the maximum rate that they could, with rare exceptions. And in every case, what they filed in support of the rate, that they didn't just file a calculation to show what the maximum rate is, but the rate that they filed that we paid showed that it included accelerated depreciation. There was over 100 rate filings where they filed telling us, the shippers, and the FERC what was in those rates. And in every one of those rate filings, they told us there was accelerated depreciation and the TSM elements were included in those rates. They were not required to file a rate. They were not required to file a rate with TSM elements. They could have used 154B for the last 20 years in straight line. And if they had used straight line, I would not be here arguing that you should use settlement balances. I'm here arguing you should use the balances that we paid that were included in our rates. It has nothing to do with the fact that it was in their settlement. It has to do with it's the way they set the rates that we paid. The Texaco SFPP case was a case where there was contracts before there was jurisdiction asserted by the FERC.
That's a helpful description for me, because I wasn't entirely, but this is what the commission meant by what was it, $451 million would have been double recovered. Is that the explanation you just gave is why it would be double recovered?
The $450 million issue?
Well, I may have the wrong number, but I'm talking about the accelerated depreciation.
Well, there's two things. One is that there was a rate base reduction of $450 million for which they were not entitled to a return component. Their position is they didn't recover it. In fact, it was recovered prior to 1985 in full, and it went to reduce the refund obligations, i.e., we would have got more refunds if they wouldn't have got to subtract it. We paid for it. The other thing is accelerated depreciation. With regard to accelerated depreciations, the rates that we've paid ever since 1977 include accelerated depreciation. And they're here saying, because they also included accelerated depreciation in their maximum rate calculation in a settlement, that we shouldn't get the credit for the rates that we paid that included the accelerated depreciation when they were under no obligation in the settlement to file for those accelerated depreciations since 85.
Okay.
DRNR. Judge Williams, I think you hit it on the head. DRNR is unique, and let me explain in a few brief phrases why. To get DRNR, you don't have an expense in your base period. You don't get to include it in your test period under the known and measurable standard. What you're talking about is pre-collecting money that you may or may not have to pay for a contingent liability that may exist 50 years from now. This is a very unique rate element, and so please appreciate that uniqueness. There's a long line of precedent that says that DRNR and negative salvage accrue to the benefit of the shippers, and that's what we're asking you to do here. We think DRNR is ripe. It's being spent today. The ruling before indicated
it's being collected.
No, it's being spent today.
That raises an interesting point.
Is activity going on?
Yes. They're going through strategic reconfiguration of the pipeline. Whenever they dismantle any existing facility along the pipeline to upgrade it, they spend the money. So they're not just collecting the money and we'll worry about it 50 years from now. They spend it as they go along.
That raises an interesting question. There is no requirement that they have to keep this in a separate segregated fund.
At different times, different regulators have reached different results on whether there should be a separate segregated fund or not. In this particular case, they didn't choose that there would be because they used a negative fund calculation, sinking fund calculation in this particular case.
So what guarantee is there that the money's going to be there when the pipeline's life ends?
Well, they've provided corporate guarantees that it will be. Other than that, I don't know the answer to your question.
What is a corporate guarantee?
Well, it's a guarantee that all their parent companies are on the hook for the obligation in full, including the refund obligation, if there's any. Yeah. Let me say, this is analogous to a security deposit. You don't know if a penny of this is ever going to be spent. When you move into your apartment, they say you're going to charge you $1,000 in rent and $1,000 in security deposit. If there's damage, they're going to use your security deposit, so you pay it. After you leave that lease, you don't want to hear, when you don't have any damage, that you don't get your security deposit back, that somehow it's being recharacterized as rent. And that's what they're trying to do here. They've taken money from us.
Hundreds of pipelines all over the country since the beginning of the previous century. I mean, how's this been handled with them?
Well, it's traditionally been considered negative salvage. It's been accounted for. It's a separate accounting entry, and it goes to the benefit of the shippers. The only cases where DRNR, where the refundability of DRNR has come forward, like the Kaparik case in Alaska, it's been deemed refundable. This is a pre-collection.
Okay, negative salvage, could you elaborate a little?
Well, negative salvage is, what do you do? It's a concept of DRNR. What happens if you end up at the end of the day, your rate payers pay the cost of your facilities, you've got a facility at the end, you can sell it for $1,000.
Okay.
Who gets the $1,000? Goes to the benefit of the rate payers who paid for that facility over the term of its life. And there are accounting entries that do that. So So the disposition of the assets at the end.
And if in fact it turns out to be more costly to get rid of the net cost of closing the operation down is positive, what happens?
Well, what they do is they're entitled to apply anytime they want. In this case, they do annual or every 2 or 3 years, they do DRNR studies, where they try and determine exactly how much is needed, and they have the opportunity to come back for the regulator to monitor that as a contingent expense and to request additional funds if they need it before the pipeline goes out of service. So that's the way it's handled on tax.
So the loads of pipelines all over the country where a similar collection has been made, and it's been for decades found to be refundable?
Well, the refundability has come up more recently with regard to DRNR. I don't think that there's a case that addresses the refundability in DRNR that holds that DRNR isn't refundable. The Kapara case is the immediate one that comes to mind.
For some reason or other, the case is saying that it will be refundable are all relatively recent, as far as I can make out from
yes,
the briefs.
Yes, that's true. And before that, there was the concept of negative salvage, and the concept of negative salvage is if you got something left over at the end of this pipeline, having to do with the disposition of the assets, that accrues to the benefit of the ratepayer who paid for all the recovery of investment.
What hardship, if any, to your clients would be felt by a ruling that this issue is not ripe?
I think it would create some confusion for the next 50 years. Like I said, this money is being collected and it's being paid out. Who has an interest in that fund and what the interest may be, I think should be clarified. And I think that from time to time there is a tremendous regulatory interest in ensuring that this unique rate element that's a pre-collected cost that may or may not ever be expensed 50 years in the future. They got the right to collect this money under unique circumstances, not under traditional cost-based principles. But the concept of it is it's revenue neutral, and that's in the record. It's a revenue neutral fund, and you can't make return on the cost, and they don't get to over-collect and keep the money. And there's a tremendous interest, I would think, in maintaining in these pipelines, because they all got to come out of service. And you want to monitor these DRNR funds, you want to be sure they're properly collected, you want to be sure that the stakeholders, that the monies get distributed to the proper stakeholders at the proper time, and you're asking the regulator to take the money from us when they really can't prove it, that they're entitled to it under conventional standards. It's not an expense they're incurring, and so it needs to be protected.
I'm sorry, you say it's in the record that it's to be revenue neutral, but in the record as of documents of what date?
I think
It seems to me the case becomes a no-brainer for you if it's in the record in 1977. Mm-hmm. It gets a little more tricky as the time moves out.
Yeah, I think the carriers will acknowledge that the purpose of DRNR is intended to be a revenue-neutral position element. I think that's the way they presented it, and that's the way they presented it subsequent. I think that's their current position, so I'd be curious to see if they change it. I wanted to say a couple things about the uniform rate. One is nobody is being forced to do anything in the uniform rate. Anybody can file whenever they want, and they do, and they file different rates. What the uniform rate is, there will never be rate stability on taps if there's not a uniform rate. And what the uniform rate does is acknowledge the reality that even though you have five owners, you have one pipe.
Well, we don't have a uniform rate before us, right? We have an order that says that sometime there will be a uniform rate.
Yeah, you have a requirement that there be
a requirement rate. Right.
That's correct. And my appeal to you with regard to the uniform rate is just to understand that the only way you can set a rate on taps is with system-wide cost and system-wide throughputs. And so you have to have a uniform rate. They can file whenever they want, and FERC has allowed them to file whenever they want. But what, in order to determine what the rate for one owner is, you have to determine the rate for the whole system. The rates are based on cost of providing service, not on who owns it. And the cost of providing service are the same for all the owners here, and there's no reason the rates should be different. So if one owner files, then everybody else, what the FERC is forced to do is to set what a reasonable cost of service is for the entire system. Finally, two more comments, and I'll sit down. I apologize for going over. One is that the settlement agreement between the state and the carriers has not been changed, modified, or abrogated in any way, shape, or form ever. I just want to be clear with that because they go into the change of methodology. There isn't a change of methodology. What there is what was actually included in rates. And the commission And the rights that the commission preserved when it approved this settlement were exactly the rights that Anadarko and Tesoro exercised to protest the rate and to have the commission review it under 15.7 and be entitled to the refunds. And that's exactly what happened. So that was what the deal was when they approved the settlement, and that's what the deal that FERC enforced. They didn't change anything. They enforced the deal that they made with the carriers at the time they approved the settlement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brenner. Mr. Reed, we gave the intervener some extra time. We'll give you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If you can do it in about 2 or 3 minutes.
Let me start with DRNR, since that came up after my argument, and a number of things have been said about that. I think the only point on which we agree with the interveners is we also believe the DRNR issue is ripe, this is a purely legal issue. The commission has said what they've said about it, and right now the carriers have kind of a sword of Damocles hanging over them for the next 20 or 30 years, that dollars they collected in good faith under the rates from 1977 to 2004, which were not subject to protest, not subject to complaint, not suspended, not made subject to refund in any way, are suddenly being labeled by the commission as refundable. And while this issue won't mature for a long time, that threat hangs over them for all of the intervening periods. The analogy that was made by counsel for the interveners to a security deposit goes right to the point. When you make a security deposit on your apartment, you normally have a lease, and there's an agreement, and it says what's going to happen to your security deposit at the end of the term. Here, there was no agreement. There was nothing in the settlement agreement about this.
He drew another analogy, and that was to negative salvage.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would like to speak to that. Ordinarily, if you have a pipeline and you're depreciating it and you think at the end of the life it's going to have a positive value, you can sell the scrap for $1,000, you only depreciate the part that you aren't going to recover at the end. You make an estimate of what that's going to be, and you recover the 99%. That's your recovery, and you leave the rest, and therefore the shippers never pay that amount.
Apparently, unsurprisingly, it turns out that sometimes the amount recovered at the end is more than the what it would be if the depreciation had been absolutely
precisely
accurate.
So, Your Honor, and I think the point is, contrary to what we were told, I don't believe it is the case generally that that is trued up at the end, if you will, that there's some kind of payment at the end of the day, because if you're only depreciating 99% of your rate base because you think you're going to get 1,000 back, and it turns out you guessed wrong and you only get 500 back, you no longer have shippers. You're now at the end of the life. You can't get those dollars back anymore. And similarly, if you estimated it was going to cost you $1,000 more, so you've been recovering up front for DRNR, when you get to the end of the life and it turns out it cost you $2,000, there are no shippers to go to get that money from. Now, if the commission, as they have in a number of cases, sets a condition in the initial rate case and says these dollars, we're going to let you collect for DRNR, but one of the conditions of doing that is you have to refund if there's a difference at the end of the life, they clearly have the power to do that, but they didn't do that in this case. And going to your point, Judge Williams, about what's happened in the past, I think the Park decision, to my knowledge, is the first time the commission had ever addressed the issue of the refundability of DRNR. That came 6 years after the TAP settlement agreement was entered into. The carriers were clearly not on notice when they made that agreement that anything they were collecting in the settlement was subject to refund, other than through the process that was just discussed, i.e., at any time during that 20 years, the shippers could have come in and complained and said, you're collecting too much money, or DRNR or anything else, made these rates subject to refund, and had that out now. Are we collecting too much? But having the dollars having been collected, those became part of the general earnings of the TAPS carriers and were no longer, we think, subject to refund under any version of either retroactive rate making or the filed rate doctrine.
So in Tarpon and Endicott, there was notice in the beginning?
Yes. In all of those cases, it was a condition imposed in the very first rate case that the dollars would be, if collected, they would be subject to refund. Here, there was no such notice and no such condition imposed. And to go to the revenue neutral point, I think Judge Randolph had it exactly right. Everything in your rates, you intend to be revenue neutral. That's the whole point of test period rate making. Sometimes, however, it turns out that you either gain or lose, and there's no general principle that says years later you go back and say, well, you collected a little too much or a little too little, and we're going to correct for that. That's what the filed rate doctrine is all about. And the commission recognized that in this very case when Williams came in, Williams Company, not Judge Williams, and asked for refunds from the prior period of DRNR. They said, look, we were a shipper in the early period. We're not going to ship in the future. So we overpaid our share of DRNR, and that should be refunded to us and collected from someone else. And the commission said, no, we can't do that. That's retroactive rate making. Well, all the Williams was asking for is the same thing we think the shippers asked for here, which is let's go back and correct for what happened in the past. That's just not one of the commission's.
Distinguish whether it's a significant distinction is open, but it did involve a sort of mid-course change in the allocation of the money before anybody was informed as to what would be needed.
Right, but the theory essentially was the same, which was the shipper was saying, I overpaid for this expense, and the commission said, well, whether that's true or not, we're not going to go back and revisit the past because we're not allowed to. The only other point I would make, it came up in the argument of the FERC solicitor about the Lakehead case, and I don't think we're overstating that. I think it is the commission's general policy under 154B that when a pipeline comes in and files a rate for the first time under that new methodology, which is essentially what we have here. This is the first time the TAPS carrier's rates have been adjudicated under 154B. The proper approach is to go back to 1983 and work forward and figure out what the rate base is today. And that's all we asked for in this case. What we got instead was a situation where the commission treated that settlement as the source of all balances, not the normal 154B process. And what we heard from the interveners was, well, we weren't relying on the settlement, we were relying on these rate filings. But bear in mind, the rate filings, as they described them, were simply the settlement compliance filings that the carriers voluntarily agreed to make as part of the settlement agreement. They said, we'll provide the state of Alaska and the FERC every year a document along with our rate that shows what the ceiling rate is under the settlement, so the state can tell whether or not we've complied. Those were filed under seal. They were not made part of the public record. There's no indication they weren't filed under the commission's regulations. They didn't have the same force, binding force, that would have been true if the carriers had been making actual regulatory rate filings in each of those years. This was just an aspect of the settlement, and the commission is trying to do through that back door what they can't do directly, which is go to the settlement for these balances.
Move back for a moment to DR&R. I take it that the perhaps I'm wrong, the carriers would not have an objection to funds collected after the, I guess, the date of opinion 502 for DR&R being refundable.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. There was no DR&R allowance in the rates the commission set for 2005 and 6, and the carriers haven't sought a DR&R allowance in any of the subsequent filings. So the last collections were done in 2004, which is the last year in which there were rates that were not in the protest.
So the period what is the period involved here?
It started with January 1, 2005. So for the prospective period, if you will, from 2005 onward, there is no DR&R collection in the rates, and therefore this issue hasn't really arisen.
The period when there was $800 and some million originally set I don't know if that number's right, but
approximately, yes.
Was that set in 85?
Yes, Your Honor. That was part of the settlement was, as in this ceiling rate methodology, there was an allowance for DR&R that was based on an estimate at that time of $872 million.
Okay, so that's in 1985 money. So does it mean that you accelerated that? Does it mean that you've collected in 1985 money, you've already collected that sum and are just so you don't need any more? Is that the idea?
Well, there was evidence in the record that put the amount of that $872 million plus earnings at somewhere in the $1.5 billion range over that period. And the carriers have not sought to collect any additional funds, although they haven't waived their right if they concluded that, DR&R was going to cost $50 billion at some point and they don't have a $50 billion fund. They could presumably come back and ask for more in the future, but they haven't done so. That hasn't occurred up to this date.
But my question was, had the carriers already collected the amount that was set in 85, the $871 million? Is that why in 1985 dollars, is that why on a going forward basis they're not collecting anymore?
Well, that they have certainly collected that amount under the commission's view of TSM, but the question of why or when they might seek to collect more isn't answered by the record. Presumably, right. They haven't felt like they have to collect more at this point, but no one's certain how much it's going to cost in 20 or 30 years, and so.
I thought the idea was that if you made a mistake and didn't estimate enough, then you have to eat that. In the same way you just said that
if we don't come back and justify more, I think that's correct, and the commission would have to decide at that point whether, you know, they were going to let the carriers collect anymore. We don't know whether they would or not, but as things stand right now, if the carriers never file for another dollar of DRNR, they would have to pay solely with whatever funds they have at the moment. And as was pointed out, their parent companies are on the hook for the entire amount. Even if DRNR costs, you know, 10 times what they've collected, parent companies have to pay.
And if they do file and if the commission approves new DRNR charges, and then at the end of the day, when this final dismantling comes about, which pot of money would the money come from first? The part accumulated, let's assume, non-refundable up to 2005 and refundable after 2005.
Well, I think the commission would have to address that question if the carriers were to seek more. What would be the standard for that? But I assume that the carriers would have to say, this is how much we have. They first have to establish how much they had and then show that there was some incremental cost that hadn't been accounted for by that amount. I think, frankly, that will be a very daunting task, which may explain why it hasn't been asked for.
But that suggests that, I mean, at least it's a scenario under which the whole issue of the refundability of the charges up through 2004 would make no difference.
Well, I wouldn't say it would make no difference, Your Honor. I think if the carriers came in and said, look, the Department of Interior has told us that we previously estimated we weren't going to have to dig up all the buried pipe and move it out of Alaska, but now the Department of Interior has told us we have to do that, so there's an extra $10 billion of cost that was never included in any prior part of this, and that was made refundable, it seems to me you would be measuring the incremental revenue against that $10 billion incremental cost, not looking at the entire cost and going back to get the old dollars that were non-refundable. Because the whole point of collecting additional dollars would be for some identified incremental cost you didn't have before.
I'll think about it.
Hearing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Reed. Mr. Louie.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to be brief. We've been going a while, so I'll just make five brief points. First, with regard to remedy, what we have is a unique situation here. The state of Alaska is not a shipper. We have the TAP settlement agreement. And that's the non-shipper nature of the state of Alaska is an issue that the Supreme Court recognized in the TAP's rate cases. That's a case that has been cited, and it was cited in our briefs, and that's where they say that reparations are a particularly ineffective remedy, and that's why they said.
What did they say followed from that?
That they allowed the commission in that case to impose a refund condition not on the new rates. In 15.7, the interpretation was only for the increased rates, and the court held that the reparations were not going to be a sufficient relief here, so that they allowed the commission to impose a refund condition on the entire new rate so that the new rates for TAPs, these were the initial rates for TAPs, could be adjudicated, and that there would be proper relief at the end of the day for the protestants. And so here, it's the same situation where the state is not a shipper, and so this proof of damages and competitive injury is not going to be something that the state has. It's not a shipper. And the cases that are cited by counsel.
What's the amount of money that Alaska receives calculated?
Alaska receives amounts of under its royalty interest, which is approximately, I think, around 14%. And then there's a complex production tax statute that calculates the production tax on the net back value of the oil.
The royalty interest is on the, what, it's like a severance tax, is it?
There's a royalty interest on the oil produced from the state lands.
Oh, from the state land. Okay. But I thought most of this was federal land anyway.
Yeah, there's a significant amount of state land involved.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
And so the cases cited under by FERC, counsel for FERC supposedly requiring a damages showing are Section 3.1 cases. Section 2 does not have a damages requirement. Section 2, you show differences in rates for like and contemporaneous service. That's what Farmers Union says. That's what the ICC versus Baltimore and Ohio Railroad says. So there is no damages requirement. And here, the state is also entitled to enforce the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement, as this court has held in LaClade, most recently in the SFPP decision, can give the commission additional powers that it doesn't ordinarily have under the statutory scheme. So at a minimum, the state is entitled to relief under the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement, which, you know, it says right up front, the parties intend this agreement to result in non-discriminatory rates, and it does that under the provisions of Section 211E, which requires the TAPS carriers to charge actual rates that are free from discrimination.
I can't resist this. I have a rhetorical question for you. But if in fact you receive, the state receive refunds, right, of the sort you're asking for, would you refund the taxes that you've collected from these companies?
It's actually the opposite. What happens is the refunds go to the shippers, and then the shippers have to file an amended tax return or an amended royalty return to reflect the lower rates that they actually paid. And then they also have to pay the differential back to the state.
Okay.
So that's how that works. And finally, Judge Garland, you asked a question about how this discrimination arose, and I should have probably been more clear. The RCA order, the Regulatory Commission order, came out in June of 2004. The TAPS carriers filed the 2005 rates that are the subject of this case 6 months later in December, I think 15th or 14th of 2004. And they filed rates that were significantly higher than the $1.96 and did not eliminate the discrimination.
It's not a question of lowering the rates, interstate rates after the...
No, the state did not challenge the 2004 rates. They challenged the rates once the new rate filing came in.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Eric. I think we've heard from everybody. Yes, good. Okay, the case will be taken under submission.
I can't have a drink in the summer. To the ordinance.